All right, so let's just chaz a little bit. We had the questions from last week. We went through a number of the mikoros from last week, but we didn't really go through the questions to see whether we covered the territory that would enable us to answer the questions. So I think that we did with respect to at least some of the cases. So let me test your memory or your interpretation of the sources. So the first question presented, Ruvain summoned Shimon to Betin. Shimon refuses to submit to its jurisdiction. Can Ruvain take Shimon to civil court? Anybody?
Two opinions.
Two opinions?
Yeah. One says it's automatic, he could go.
Uh-huh.
And the other one says, no, you got to go to Beis Din and get a heter from them to go.
Excellent. Okay, very good. Yeah, according to the Gemara and Baba Kama, it seems like it's automatic. And according to the Mishnah in Gittin, it would seem like you need the shlichu, you need the agency of the Beis Din. That seems to be supported by the Chasam Sofer. Next, does he have to prove the validity of his claim from the perspective of Jewish law in order to be allowed to go to civil court when Shimon refuses to go to Beis Din? Does he have to prove the validity of his claim according to Jewish law, based on what we learned last week?
According to the second opinion.
According to the second opinion, it's arguable that he should have to prove the validity. That's what Rav Chaim Cohn argues in an article that he wrote. According to the second opinion, that would explain the opinion of the Nesivos HaMishpat, the Aruch HaShulchan, that on some level he has to prove his claim. And the other approach, which is articulated by the Imre Bina and others, that we don't find that we require Ruvain to prove his claim in Beis Din first, and that's the general practice of Bati Din nowadays, will be more consistent with the other opinion that says that it would be automatic, as almost as a knas, right, a penalty, that we throw the wall at him, right? This is the expression of the Gemara, right? Rami Guda. Okay, I'm going to skip the second question for now because I don't think we covered that territory. And I'm going to skip the third question because we didn't cover that territory. Now, what if Shimon took Ruvain to court? Let's switch the tables a little bit. Ruvain, Shimon sues Ruvain, and after a few months of answering his claim, Ruvain says, well, I guess you took me to court. I have the right to answer your claim. That's what we say as a matter of halacha. But Avaya Yosef, others write that Ruvain has no choice. He's not committing the Isser. If he's just saving himself, the civil courts exercise the automatic jurisdiction against him because Shimon took him to court. He has the right to defend himself. But after a few months of answering the claim of Shimon and litigating the case in civil court together with Shimon, Ruvain turns to Beis Din and asks for the Beis Din to summon Shimon to adjudicate the case in Beis Din instead. He didn't do this right away. He did it after a few months, right? So what should we say in that case? So do we allow Ruvain to insist that Shimon be summoned to Beis Din, or do we say too little, too late? We discussed this towards the end last time.
Will a civil court give up their jurisdiction?
Will a civil court give up their jurisdiction? They will give up their jurisdiction in the event that, let's say, Ruvain now turns around and he says to Shimon, you took me to civil court, I want to take you to Beis Din. And Shimon says, oh, well, I didn't know you want to go to Beis Din. Fine, so I'll agree, I'll go to Beis Din. The two of them sign a shtar beruin. Civil court will be more than happy to give up the jurisdiction. They'll say, oh, you opted for arbitration. Shimon will withdraw his case against Ruvain with prejudice, maybe without prejudice. His lawyers will say, oh, make it without prejudice because we never know what's going to happen. But one way or another, the case can be removed from civil court. Civil court will be happy to say, bye-bye, we'll let you go.
It probably wouldn't even dismiss the case. It probably just stay the proceedings. So if there's already a case filed, it probably stay the proceedings, and then whatever the result is from the Beis Din would be entered as a judgment.
Stay the case pending arbitration. And then you can enter the arbitration judgment. In fact, they might even have the parties sign the stipulation in front of the court, that they stipulate, that they agree that they're going to arbitrate the case in front of Beis Din and wherever they'll go. That can even be done in court, not a problem. Perfectly fine to do it in that fashion, as long as they show that they are going to be mechabe the Beis Din, they're going to accept upon themselves the jurisdiction of the Beis Din. So yes, let's assume that's not going to be a problem. The civil court will let them go. So what do you say?
Shimon is not belittled or punished for going to civil court without Beis Din's decision or approval?
Well, it's perfectly possible that when the case makes its way back to Beis Din, if Shimon agrees that he will go to Beis Din upon Ruvain's request for the case to be removed and reinstated in Beis Din, that the first thing that Ruvain will do is say, I want to collect my legal expenses for the amount that I had to pay out because he took me to court. And so this is addressed a little bit by the Maharsham. Let's go to source Gimel over here. The Maharsham was dealing with a case where the Tobeya had taken the Nitva to civil court. At some point, the Nitva filed to recover expenses that he had to shell out because he was taken to a civil court by the Tobeya. There are a number of different nuances in this tshuva of the Maharsham, where the Maharsham ends up covering a lot of territory because it was a type of claim that was arguably a case where maybe the Tobeya had the right to take the Nitva to civil court because it was so clear-cut. It was basically a collection action. We're going to go into that. But leaving aside that aspect, which is the second paragraph of the Maharsham, let's focus on the first paragraph of the Maharsham. This Maharsham really covers a lot of very important territory. So Shlomo Shwadron. So the Maharsham says, what if Reuven now wants to collect all of his expenses from the fact that Shimon had taken him to civil court? So he says, well, Reuven only went to the civil court in order to save his skin because Shimon had summoned him to go to the civil court. So he reinforces this idea, like you don't have to quote Rav Yosef, it's right here in the Maharsham. He doesn't need Rishus Bezdin in order to defend himself when he's the one who was sued in civil court to begin with. We don't need anything. He could just go straight without even getting the permission of the Bezdin. The permission is considered to already be provided automatically once the Tovea, the other party, takes him to civil court. But he says, however, there was something about this case that makes me uncomfortable with respect to Reuven's counterclaim against Shimon. What makes me uncomfortable? She also nipa kama hotzos. The nipa didn't only just go once to civil court, like the first day that he was summoned. The nipa went once, he went twice, he went a third time, he hired a lawyer, he filed a cross motion, he got kind of engaged in the case, he got very involved in the case. And he made the other side take an oath. He issued his own interrogatories, his own depositions. He was, you know, getting very, very involved and immersed in the case. Medine umos ha'olam, ala tovea. So v'adei shayim v'dai t'lodum medine umos ha'olam. Even though he wasn't originally the culprit, in the end he was also the culprit. Even though he didn't start the case in civil court, if he really sincerely believed that the case should be litigated in Beis Din, then even though he didn't have to, but he certainly could have said at the very, very beginning, as soon as he received the summons from civil court, he could have said, you know what, I want this case to be heard in Beis Din. He could have contacted the Beis Din the first day, even though he didn't have to, but, you know, that would have indicated that he wasn't so happy or agreeable about having this litigated in civil court. Yes?
Except, however he got to civil court, if he doesn't, you know, mount a zealous defense and mount any cross claims, which would otherwise be waived if he doesn't mount them, I don't think there's a mitzvah that if you're getting dragged into civil court that you have to be run over in the process.
As long as Shimon is continuing to refuse to remove the case from civil court and to bring the case instead to Beis Din, of course, then Reuven would be within his rights to very assiduously argue his side of the case in a civil court. But he could do both, meaning from day one, he could have the Beis Din send a summons to Shimon, saying, Shimon, you took Reuven to civil court. That wasn't nice that you took Shimon to civil court. Shimon really wants to go to Beis Din. And then if Shimon agrees, good. And if Shimon doesn't agree, then he can continue to assiduously argue his case. But he didn't even take that step. What is it? It's a phone call to Beis Din. It doesn't take so long. You could assiduously argue your case and at the same time try to have the case removed to Beis Din, but he didn't take that step. So says the Maharsham, if Reuven himself was not committed to having the case heard in civil court, then he would not have pursued his own counter motions, okay, in civil court. I mean, this is clearly a case where he's filed counter motions, and now you know, maybe he sees the case isn't going so well. It's not really going so much in his favor. So this is almost like the flip side of what the Ramah, you know, spoke about, of the person who wants to get two bites of the apple, of the Tobeah who sues the Nitba in civil court, loses the case, decides to become a Baal Tshuva, and then file a case against him in Beis Din, where the Ramah says, so sorry, you only get one bite of the apple. So here the Maharsham is saying, this doesn't only apply to the Tobeah, this can apply to the Nitba too. If the Nitba decides that he's going to continue to really pursue and litigate the case because he was brought to a civil court and he's filing all these cross motions, and only when things might not be going so well, then he wants to remove the case to Beis Din, and so then he's not necessarily entitled to all of the privileges anymore. But Hayalo, it's you can engage in self-defense while at the same time trying to do the right thing. He can engage in self-defense while at the same time also sending a summons from a Beis Din to Shimon saying, I want to have this case removed from or transferred from a civil court to Beis Din.
He didn't do that when he
didn't do it. This is what the Maharsham right now says right now. Look at the next words. The Hayah Lo Lazmino. Oz Ladin Torah Mikodim. He should have, at a much earlier point in time, have summoned Shimon to the Din Torah rather than waiting so long. Okay? He should have certainly not administered oaths, meaning what we would call, you know, the same type of situation as a person filing cross motions and cross claims in civil court. That would be the equivalent type of posture from our perspective, and he should have summoned him instead to Beis Din before filing all of his cross motions. Okay.
But all this dependent on the culture and the time frame. Maybe our Beis Din, let's say, would meet only on Monday and Thursday. In that city, maybe the Beis Din met once a month. Maybe the it was a very aggressive, anti-Semitic type of court. And I mean, there are a lot of...
It could very well be. And maybe, and I don't think that the Maharsham was an unreasonable person, as we'll see as he goes on and speaks about the other aspects of the Tshuva. If he really felt that Beis Din could not have done anything during this time, then he wouldn't be using this language. Obviously, a long, protracted period of time had lapsed before Reuven suddenly woke up and decided that he wanted to take this case to Beis Din. This Maharsham is also quoted by the She'arim HaMitzuyonim Bahalacha, who also kind of even expands the interpretation of the Maharsham, that we're talking about a Nitba that really waited to see how things would go in civil court. And only when things weren't quite going his way did he decide, you know what, I'm really a tzaddik. This guy, Shimon, he was a Rosh Hashanah taking me to civil, and I'm going to show the Beis Din I'm really a tzaddik. But it depends when you show you're a tzaddik. Are you waiting like Haran to see what happens to Avam and the Kibshon HaEish, and then you're going to jump in yourself, or are you going to jump in right away? This fellow, he didn't jump in right away. He just wanted to wait and see what happens. And then when he figures that it's in his best interest to go to Beis Din, only then does he go to Beis Din. So then you don't get quite nearly as good a deal from the standpoint of halacha. Let's look at the after the parentheses. He clearly had made up his mind that he was going to pursue this case and rely upon the judgment and the authority of the secular courts. Yes?
I was going to say, would the Maharsham be swayed by the level of the respondent's activity? For example, all right, I filed my answer, which is the response to being sued to the complaint, and I responded to their discovery, but I didn't take a deposition. I did a minimal written discovery to meet the guidelines, so I wouldn't be barred.
I think so. The Maharsham doesn't articulate it, but I think it's extremely implicit in the way in which the Maharsham is expressing his argument.
Read the next sentence.
All right. Okay.
V'kivan, that's a purely defensive posture here.
Right. Well, the next sentence he talks about nigmar hadin. V'kivan shekvar nigmar hadin shenishba tover from machar abayis. But if you look at what happened, it's not nigmar hadin in the sense that necessarily there was a verdict that was issued. Shenishba tover from machar abayis. There were things that happened as a result of the actions that were taken. Okay. So, in this sense of what the Beis Din of America, for example, concluded from this approach of the Maharsham, is that the determining factor is, has there been significant court involvement yet or not? If the Nitba has waited until the point in which there has been significant court involvement, as opposed to merely registering a response so he's not going to end up losing his rights and privileges and just having an immediate verdict issued against him and so forth, but has rather gone above and beyond what would be absolutely necessary to do in order to defend himself and protect his skin prior to reaching out to the Beis Din. So then he has forfeited his right at least to be able to stand on the high moral ground and say, I'm much better than you, and therefore a seruv, a contempt order, should be issued against Shimon in the event that Shimon at that point in time refuses to have the case transferred to the Beis Din.
What does Mochar Habayit mean in this context?
This was a case, it was like a foreclosure action, okay?
And so it already went through.
Right. Ein l'chayavis Reuven l'eve enimo l'din Torah, sh'gam anitfak v'anisratze b'zeh sh'neim kiblu al atzmam dinin d'malchuse. Yes. You're right. One extreme way of reading, I suppose that, you know, the most favorable or unfavorable, you know, way to read, or most favorable way to read the tshuva of the Maharsham towards the Nitba himself would be that to say that the Nitba preserves his right no matter how much he is engaged in the court action as long as the final verdict has not yet been issued. But I think that one could, just based on the spirit of what the Maharsham is saying over here, that he already was Matil Shvua. He doesn't necessarily make it dependent, even though he describes the Gemara Din at the end. He says there's already been significant outcomes as a result of the involvement of the Nitba in the case. It would seem that one could argue, especially nowadays with a modern day court action in which the litigation takes many different forms and there are interim motions and decisions that are decided by the court along the way, that there are many Gemara Dins, okay, along the way. That's why we talk about significant court involvement, when the court is already showing its hand in terms of, you know, various interim decisions that are being made during the course of the litigation, that it's a very, very plausible for a Beis Din to look at the situation and say, you know why the Nitba is coming to us? Because the Nitba sees that things aren't going so well for them based on the significant court involvement that has occurred up until this time. And therefore, they have forfeited their right to stand on the high moral ground and to insist upon a contempt order being issued against the Tovei at that point in time. If you go down a little bit towards the end of the second paragraph, he quotes from Rameir Auerbach, who's the author of the Imre Bina, seems to have been a contemporary of the Maharsham. This is, we're talking about late 19th century at this point in time. And he quotes from the Sefer Imre Bina. This is the parentheses towards the very end. Meir Gaon of Moshe Auerbach, Rameir Auerbach, Shehela, he makes a very interesting compromise. It happens that he quotes this compromise and then rejects it, but the Maharsham only quotes the Havamina because he finds the Havamina, I suppose, more interesting than the Maskana. But he quotes an approach towards this type of situation in which he says, well, maybe when the Nitba comes to Beis Din and says, I want to recover my costs because the Toveya took me illegitimately to Beis Din, and we know that the Nitba remained in Beis Din I was taken illegitimately to civil court, and we know that the Nitba remained in civil court longer than he needed to remain in civil court, so we can distinguish between what were his costs to defend himself in the very first summons, which were illegitimate, and what were the costs that he incurred afterwards. So he says, I found in this Sefer Imre Bina, Shehela de the Ian Hotsa Shetaveya Nitba Shigaram Lo Hotaveya Bedine Yomas Olam, that if the Nitba now goes to the Beis Din to recover his expenses, Ein Lefsok Rak Hotsa Achas, he only gets his original expenses. Whatever was the first expense he had to incur at the time that the Nitba was first taken by the Toveya to civil court, so that he's entitled to be reimbursed for. Aval Ma Shehotsi HaToveya Bedine Yomas Olam Belovish Yis Beis Din Ein Sok Nitba L'Shalim Klum. However, that which the I think the wording here is a little bit the wording here is a little bit mixed up. I think and that the Nitba it does not have to
it should be Mashotzi
right,
Nitba.
Right. It should be I think so, that Gam Hotza Beis V'Gimel, that the Nitba does not have to pay beyond the first expense, the Nitba does not get to recover from the Toveya beyond the first expense that he had to outlay, according to, you know, this compromise approach. And we can understand that because the Nitba could certainly be justified in saying that I had no right, that I was taken by then Tovea without any right on his part to Bez to civil court to begin with, and therefore he has to reimburse me for my first expense. But if the Nipah chooses to remain there afterwards, so then the Nipah no longer can insist upon reimbursement for further expenses. So this relates to the question.
In this last sentence, then yeah. The words Tovea and Nipah reverse.
I think so, yes. Okay. Because certainly that's what, in the Imre Bina himself, in the Sefer Imre Bina himself, that certainly is what he was talking about. The Imre Bina was talking about to which expenses the Nipah has the right to insist upon collecting. So this question came up at the end of the session last time, which was at what point in time do we say that if the Nipah remained in civil court, that the Nipah can no longer insist on going back and summoning the Tovea to Beis Din. So what happens in Beis Din from a practical perspective? If the case has already been in civil court for a long period of time, we'll do as follows. If the Nipah comes to us and says, we want to be able to summon the Tovea, even though we did not summon right away, we'll send the Hazmana. Because you can always send the Hazmana, there's nothing wrong with that. We'll send the summons because maybe the Tovea also will agree that they wanted to remove the case from civil court and transfer it to Beis Din at that point in time. But in the event that the Tovea refuses to comply with the summons and says, well, if the Nipah wanted to take me to Beis Din, they should have summoned me much earlier, we will not issue a contempt order against the Tovea at that point in time. Well, normally, the Tovea would be subject to a contempt order. We have a case right now where the Tovea took the Nipah to civil court, and immediately, as soon as the Nipah received the summons, that day, the Nipah ran to Beis Din and said to the Beis Din, I want the case to be transferred to Beis Din. So in such a case, unless the Beis Din would find that there was some justifiable reason why the Tovea did not need to go to Beis Din, had the right to go to civil court, the Tovea could potentially be subject to the issuance of a seruv, of a contempt order, and the communal opprobrium as a result of refusing to submit to Beis Din. Now, if it was the other direction, a Tovea takes a Nitbah to civil court. Let's say the Tovea takes the Nitbah to civil court, and then the Tovea does tshuva, okay? But the Tovea does tshuva even before the significant court involvement. There were many poskim who said, well, if the Tovea, without any provocation whatsoever, decides to take the Nitbah to civil court, even if the Tovea then is prepared to drop the case a week or two later, and before there's been any significant court involvement of any sort, even before the Nipah has to respond to the summons of the Tovea, but there has been an official court action filed against the Nipah, so many poskim say that as a knas, as a penalty that we would then heave upon the Tovea, even though if the Tovea says, please send the Hazmana to the Nipah, we'll do so. If the Nipah said, he already summoned me illegitimately without any reshus bezdin, without any permission from bezdin to civil court, and therefore I don't feel that I have an obligation to submit to bezdin anymore, so then the Tovea has lost their right to have a contempt order issued against the Nipah in that case. So the threshold is much lower when there hasn't been any provocation whatsoever, such as when a Tovea brings the case. And now we can go back to the question, and I can pose the question to you. Yes, somebody had a question?
Yeah, what would be a situation with the Beis Din would say, we don't want to deal with it, go to the civil court?
That's a different story, because that already, then the civil court is acting in the shlichut of the Beis Din, and the civil court is acting as an agent of the Beis Din. There'd be no Isser or Kos.
Could you just give an example? I don't really
child care. Beis Din doesn't get involved in child care. And
it depends. Let's say it's not a bad example. Let's say that you had a child custody case. It happens that my own approach towards child custody is that even though child custody decisions by a Beis Din in many states, including Illinois, are not enforceable by the civil courts because of the parens patriae principle, the courts are the guardians of the children, and the parents have no right to delegate that authority to any other tribunal. Nonetheless, as a matter of halacha, the parties are obligated to adjudicate any kind of internal dispute in front of the Beis Din rather than civil court. And the parties are simply expected to respect the decision of the Beis Din on their own, even though the decision of the Beis Din can't actually be enforced in a civil court. They nonetheless are supposed to abide by it. So I would say that if the parties came in, if one party, the husband, wanted to summon the wife to Beis Din over a child custody dispute, or the wife wanted to sum, and the husband or child custody dispute, it goes both ways, and the other party refused, that would be grounds for issuing a seiruv. But not everybody agrees. Some say, well, since Beis Din can't enforce their decision, so we understand why one party is refusing to submit, because they say, well, you're going to adjudicate the entire case, and even if I prevail, I'm not going to be able to enforce my judgment, so therefore, maybe a seiruv shouldn't be issued. There are two different perspectives about this. I happen to take the more hardline perspective, because I'm really, really big on Beis Din. I'm going to Beis Din. But it's perfectly possible that in that type of case, a Beis Din might say, we don't feel that we're qualified to decide this case, or we're worried, might distinguish between different cases. In one type of, in one custodial case, the Beis Din could say, we know the parties, we know their attorneys, we know they're standing in the community, and we know that they're going to file, each party is going to follow what we say, so therefore, there's no reason to transfer this case to civil. In another case, the party, the Beis Din might say, we know these parties, and we know that the one who, you know, loses or isn't happy with the Beis Din decision is not going to respect it, so why should we burden the other party, and therefore, we will give authorization to the parties to have this case, you know, heard in civil court or filed in civil court. Okay. If that's the case, then the civil court is simply acting through the shlichut, through the agency of the Beis Din, and there wouldn't be any Yisrael Kos altogether. Yes?
What about where a Beis Din would have no original jurisdiction, for example, in an eviction matter? In the matter you mentioned, most family courts or whatever, you know, domestic courts, relations courts are very, 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 very happy when a third party can step in and arbitrate something everybody either can live with or agree to live with. For an eviction matter, what they call forcible entry, the only party that has the authority to issue a forcible entry order is the sitting judge.
You're absolutely right. So what do you do in such a case? Here you have a dispute, a legitimate dispute between different parties, which is really in the realm of mammonus, in the realm of monetary matters, which should, as a general proposition, be brought in front of the Beis Din. But there are certain aspects of the case that cannot be handled by Beis Din. So what could happen is one of two things. Either a party can say, well, this can't be handled by Beis Din anyway, therefore I'm just going to go straight to civil court. Or a party will say, I don't think that a Beis Din can handle this, so I'm going to go to the Beis Din, and I'm going to request a specific permission to initiate the eviction action in a civil court. So if it's clearly like black and white, it's just crystal clear to anybody that this is a type of matter that, you know, a Beis Din in a million years wouldn't be able to handle. So many posts can say, well, in that case, you don't even need to get the leave of permission from Beis Din before, you know, initiating the action in civil court. But if it's something which is not 100% crystal clear, because there's an action with many different aspects, and certain aspects probably would come under the jurisdiction of the Beis Din, so then you really should go to Beis Din. And what position you take regarding that question could really depend on the tutsdadim that we discussed last week. Do you say that the only justification for ever going to civil court is that they're following the agency of Beis Din, in which case you always need the explicit permission of Beis Din? Or do you say that in a case where it's so clear that the Beis Din is not going to be able to be involved because one party's refusing to go to Beis Din, you could carry it over and say, because it's a case that could not, it's a type of matter or relief or remedy that could not possibly be handled by Beis Din, so then it's automatically built in based on the principle of Ovid Inishtin Lanafshe, like the Klei Chemda says, that of course you can go to civil court in such a case. So it really would depend on those two different perspectives. What we say when it comes to eviction matters, for example, and I'll give you another illustration as well, what we would say with respect to eviction matters is the underlying claim and dispute as to whether there is a right to evict the person, whether the failure to pay rent has come is justified or unjustified or is so egregious as to warrant eviction. So that determination is really one that the Beis Din is empowered. Even according to civil court, the Beis Din would be empowered to make that determination. But the ability to evict is something which can only be done through the civil court. So what Beis Din would typically say, what the Batei Din I've been involved with have said in such cases, I remember I used to have a landlord that would come to me as a matter of course. Like every month he would bring another case to me because he was very firm, he was very God-fearing, and he didn't want to do anything that wasn't in accordance with halakha. So whenever he wanted...
His tenants were so firm they didn't pay rent?
He had a lot of tenants who needed to be evicted. It was, you know, there are landlords like that. So this landlord, you know, whenever he had a tenant who needed to be evicted, who wasn't paying their rent. So he would come to the Beis Din in order to seek permission from the Beis Din to initiate an eviction proceeding. And what we would generally do is say, in order not to lose time in the event that the Beis Din determines that you have the right to evict, you can initiate the eviction proceeding, but you have to make it clear that the adjudication of the underlying substantive claims will only take place in front of Beis Din. And even you could build that in to your eviction motion that you're planning to adjudicate, assuming that the other party is willing, you are planning to adjudicate the underlying substantive claims in front of the Beis Din.
At least in Illinois, if you're evicting for non-payment of rent, you can seek possession only, or you can seek possession and rent. Mm-hmm. So you would say that, well, for example, if somebody comes to me and says, Pilz, file the eviction, and they're from Jew versus from Jew, you would say, file the possession only claim, and then have them bring the rent claim to me.
100%. That's exactly right. Or there might be other cases where a person will lose a certain remedy in civil court if they don't do something immediately, and there's no guarantee that they'll be able to obtain the same remedy in Beis Din. Like, for example, a person has a certain claim, and they were debating internally whether they're going to file this claim or not for a long period of time. They wanted to give time to the other person to make good on their obligations, and they were very forbearing. But now they realize that they're approaching the statute of limitations for whatever their claim is. Let's say it's a breach of contract, which is, what, 3 years, 6 years, depending? What?
Generally 2 years.
2 years here in Illinois, okay.
10 years.
What?
Ten years. On a written contract.
10 years, 10 years written contract, depending on if it's a tort, it's less, right? What's a tort?
2 years.
A tort is 2 years, it's a tort action, and the person says, you know, no, I'm not getting any compensation, I'm not getting the relief, and if I don't file action in civil court soon, I'm going to lose my right. But you know what? I'm a from Jew. And I don't want to go to civil court. I'm supposed to go to Beis Din. So they file the action in Beis Din. But it's already 1 year and 11 and a half months. And the Beis Din, the process of Beis Din sending out summonses, is going to take a month and a half, until Beis Din comes to the conclusion that the other party is either agreeing to comply, refusing to comply. But what good is that going to do, the moving party, if Beis Din, after a month of sending summonses, says, you know what, we sent a month of three summonses, that's the usual amount that's sent by the Beis Din, Zman Beis Din Shloshim Yom, we gave 30 days, the other party's not complying, you know what, we're issuing a contempt order against the other party, and guess what, as a special prize, you get to sue the other party in civil court. But it's too late, because the statute of limitations has passed. So what the Beis Din would say is that you have the right, would say to the Tovea from the outset, you have the right to file an action. So you're not forfeiting your rights under Beis Din in this particular case, because we're giving you the right to file an action in civil court, just so that you can maintain your ability to toll the statute of limitations and to seek relief in the event that the other party refuses to come to Beis Din. So if the other party then says, oh, well, I don't need to go to Beis Din because the Tovea has already filed in civil court, the Beis Din will say, no, we gave the right to the Tovea to file in civil court in this case. Let's say the Tovea didn't ask permission personally from the Beis Din, but just said, I understood that it's as a matter of right, I could file for, you know, the action in civil court, because otherwise I would lose my statute of limitations, because, you know, there's no way the Beis Din would have issued relief to me to go to the civil court prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations. That would depend, again, on your perspective, whether you say that you always need to first receive the Rishus Beis Din, or whether in a case where it's crystal clear that the Beis Din wouldn't otherwise have been able to issue the relief, that you would have the right to go directly to civil court. That would be another nafkamina, that would be another ramification of that dispute.
Question. If you are in a case, it's similar to that example, but where you have to preserve a remedy, either by doing a restraining order or what's called a prejudgment attachment, where you have to freeze assets at the outset of the case because you have concerns about assets getting liquidated or whatever, you need a restraining order from the civil court because they're the only ones that can enforce it. You know, I'm assuming a Beis Din can enforce that type of thing. In those instances, you're going before a civil court and you frequently have to make some prima facie case before the civil court to preserve your remedy.
Talking about like a TRO, like a temporary restraining order, what we call a preliminary injunction,
injunctive relief,
what we refer to in halacha as an ikul, okay, that you are stopping the person from doing something. An ikul can be on a person's possessions. We say that the person, that we're going to freeze the right of the person to divest a certain property, or an ikul can be on a person, that we're going to stop a person from being able to leave the town or leave the country or run away. These are all different types of ikulim, and there's a vast literature with respect to ikulim. So let's look in the materials, okay? We'll jump around a little bit. Why not, since you brought it up? So now let's take a look at the Igros Moshe Dalit, okay? This is source Dalit.
By the way, just real quick, the end of question four, just to finish your previous part, when you said, what if Shimon himself has a change of heart in the middle of the proceedings and insists on summoning Reuven, but Reuven no longer wants to change venue, even if Reuven would want to change venue, what you told us before is that often the Beis Din will no longer allow that.
If both parties are willing to change venue, we'll allow it. We'll allow it.
But a moment ago, you were saying when you started before the other part, you said that often if before it got very involved in the court case, civil cases, you said that often the basin as a knas will say, no, sorry, you already started out, even if the toveya, you said even if you didn't yet want to take the bites.
The knas is not the refusal to send the hazmanah. Basin will always be willing to send the hazmanah because it's always better from the standpoint of halacha, from the standpoint of hashkafa, from the standpoint of honoring the Torah and honoring HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's always best to be able to persuade both parties to remove the case from a civil court back to Beis Din.
Even if the Toveya started it in civil court.
That's correct. But the difference is that we will not issue a seir, we will not issue a contempt order against the other party. In this case, if they don't want to come to Beis Din and they say, I'm sorry, it's too late, you didn't summon me when you should have summoned me back then. So we'll say that is a legitimate response in this case. Right. Okay. Yes.
Do the Dayanim have a chiyuv to understand the limitations within the
Medina? I would think so. You know, part of the obligation of a Dayan is to be in tune with with the times and with the community and with the limitations from a business perspective and from a secular legal perspective of the parties, so that the Beis Din can best guide the parties. On the other hand, what does that mean? That means that a Beis Din has to understand what are its parameters of jurisdiction. However, I don't think, and this is a question that sometimes arises, that the Beis Din has an obligation to serve as the attorneys for the parties. Meaning that if a party brings a case to Beis Din, let's say like the case that I described, and it's the 23rd month, okay, after a tort action had arisen, and the party's not asking the Beis Din, can I file this case in civil court, because I'm afraid that the statute of limitations is going to expire. And it's not raised at all. The party just says to the Beis Din, please send the summons. I don't think the Beis Din is obligated to research what is the statute of limitations for this type of claim so we can advise the party that they should, you know, file in court. I think that really is the responsibility of the party and their legal advisors. And then they can ask Beis Din whether they have a right to file. They don't have a right to file. Because I had a case like that. There was a case in the Beis Din of America, where a party, during the course of it, while the Beis Din sending the various summonses in the case, the statute of limitations for from the perspective of civil law expired. And then the party complained to Beis Din afterwards, I lost my statute of limitations. But the Beis Din said, but that wasn't our, you didn't tell us, you know, about the statute of limitations. It's not our obligation to research it. What the Beis Din did do, as a courtesy, which I thought was the right thing to do, was to write a letter just memorializing the procedural history of the case. You approach us on such and such date to open up a case in the Beis Din. We sent a summons, and we, per our practice, we sent a total of three summonses over a period of 2.5 months. Based on the different responses from the other party, we granted extensions, and we did not ultimately close the case or issue any type of a direction in the case to you that you could bring the matter to civil court until the following date. And then they could utilize that to make an argument in civil court that by virtue of the fact they opened up the case in Beis Din, and Beis Din was still dealing with the case and summoning the other party during this time, that maybe that told the statute of limitations. I don't know if it'll work, it won't work, but at least, you know, the Beis Din will provide that courtesy to the parties.
So reverse it. I'm the respondent. There's a car accident. The plaintiff comes 20 months afterwards, and they start the process, and 24 months rolls up quickly. 24 months comes and goes. I haven't yet been properly served by the Beis Din for whatever reason, but they haven't yet sent me, you know, they're on their first summons. I didn't still have the response time. Also, no, because this guy's got no legal remedy against me. He can't do anything. He can go to a Beis Din until the cows come home. Statute limitations folded. He didn't he didn't handle this in a timely fashion. What's my motivation at that point to come to the Beit Din? He doesn't have the ability to enforce the judgment.
Because you want to be a Torah abiding Jew. Okay, you know, I had a case like this in Beis Din. No, we had it because you don't want to say Ravishit against you. You don't want it because a person cares about their good standing in the community. We had a case like that in the Beis Din where the statute of limitation, at the time that the Tovea came to us to send the very first Hazmana, the statute of limitations had already expired 2 years earlier. But in Halacha, there is no statute of limitations. There's virtually never statute of limitations. A machlokis, you know, as to whether, you know, Edim after a certain amount of time, you know, can, you know, no longer render testimony because they would have forgotten. Shitas Rabbi Meir. Yeah. The Gemara comes to the conclusion, no, there's no statute of limitations. As long as the Edim remember what happened, it could be 70 years later, it could be Choni Hamago could still be a witness for somebody, you know, if he remembers what happened before he fell asleep. And a case, you know, can always be filed. We have loans that don't get automatically canceled after 7 years, but as a person, he always, you know, took care of his prosbols. None of his loans ended up getting canceled. You could bring your claims forever. There's one possible exception of an amanu who hasn't claimed her ksuvah after 25 years or so. Very, very few exceptions. As a general proposition, claims can be made forever. So therefore, as far as the Bezin was concerned, it was legitimate to send that hazmana. The Nippa said, but the statute of limitations expired. We said, statute shmachu. That doesn't mean anything from the perspective of halacha. And the person eventually, now, I shouldn't say it doesn't mean anything because it might create at least a reusa, suspicion. Why did the person wait until they no longer would have had any remedy according to secular law when they couldn't even be guaranteed that the Nippa would come around to Bezin? Doesn't that pose a question or at least a suspicion that maybe their claim isn't so glatt, it's not so strong? So there were even Rishonim who said, well, maybe we'll adjust our presumptions. If there normally would be a presumption in favor of the Tovea, so, you know, we might move over that presumption in favor of the Nitba. But it doesn't mean that you don't hear, or maybe if there was a Shvua to be taken, then we'll reallocate the Shvua to the other side. You know, Rishonim talk about this. Very nice article about this by Rav Ratzon Arusi, who's a Yemenite Dayan in Eretz Yisrael. And he runs a conference that I go to, you know, almost every single year. It's called Halichos Am Yisrael Conference. We invite Dayanim from all over the world. So he likes to deal with, like, progressive type issues. He's like a very, very progressive Taimani personality. And he published an article in Tchumen. Tchumen is a well-known Torah journal on this subject of statute of limitations according to halacha. So he makes these various arguments, but fundamentally, the statute of limitations doesn't expire. So this person then signed the Shtar Birur. They signed an arbitration agreement saying that they're going to submit their dispute in front of Beis Din. And then came time for the Beis Din to hear the case, and the person went to court, and they tried to stay and stop the Beis Din proceedings. And their argument to stop the Beis Din proceedings was, yes, it's true, I signed the arbitration agreement, but the statute of limitations has passed. So the court said, tough luck, you waived the statute of limitations because you signed the arbitration agreement. Once you sign the arbitration agreement, even though it's well known that the statute of limitations says bad, then you can't argue that as a defense. Arbitration law in New York, this took place in New York, does say the statute of limitations is a bar, can be a bar towards arbitration, towards compelling arbitration. But that's talking about a case where two parties enter into a contract when they, you know, first go into business together, saying if we ever have a dispute, we're going to take that dispute to arbitration. And then, they, after the cause of action arises, they wait till the end of the statute of limitations to compel the arbitration. But that's very different from when the arbitration agreement is first signed after the statute of limitations has passed. So the court ruled that there was no bar, and they came to the Beis Din, and we heard the case, and we adjudicated the case. So sometimes the Beis Din can't hear a statute of limitations case. But in the first instance, since we don't know, nobody can know whether the other party is going to submit to Beis Din altogether, so therefore it's legitimate for the Tovea to file the claim just to protect his or her rights prior to the Beis Din reaching a determination that the other party has refused to come to Beis Din, and maybe the other party will agree to come to Beis Din, even if the statute of limitations has passed. There are such individuals, either because they are tremendous Yirei Shemayim, we would hope that's the reason, we'll presume that's the reason no matter what, but another possible explanation could be that they're worried about their good name in the community. And which is also part of Yirei Shemayim. Sometimes Yirei Shemayim first has to be reminded of their Yirei Shemayim through punitive measures. That was, you know, the Rambam's famous explanation as to why in certain cases the Rambam held that you are allowed to beat up the husband, like we were discussing last week, because, you know, deep down he wants to do, you know, the right thing to do according to halakha. We just have to beat out the Yetzer Hara in him so that the Yetzer Hara can rise to the surface. So, you know, it's the same same sort of idea. That's really what the Beis Din has in mind. I have to tell you that working, you know, in the Beis Din for, you know, all of these years, that is really what we have in mind. We issue a seiva. We're not out to beat anybody up. We issue a seiva if it's really to, you know, try to put, you know, as much pressure as possible, you know, being, you know, as forceful as we can be according to halacha, to remind somebody of what they're supposed to do as a Torah Jew. That really is the intention. The intention is to, you know, remind somebody what, as a Yarei Shemayim, they're supposed to be doing, that they're supposed to be adjudicating the disputes in front of Beis Din. So let's turn to the Igros Moshe source Dalet over here, okay, which deals with the case of the injunction. So it says, he mentions the Beis Din. No problem. The Beis Din is not the culpable party over there. It's not Lashon Hara. This was the Beis Din. Of course, I think Moshe was a member of Agudas Rabbanim. So, you know, he does it, has no pejorative feelings towards Agudas Rabbanim. So Agudas Rabbanim was a Beis Din, still is a Beis Din, in Brooklyn, New York. Agudas Rabbanim, Shalach Hazmanus Le'ezer Baal Dover. And so they sent Hazmanus to somebody. And he got issued a jurisdictional defense. That's one of the defenses you can issue to the Beis Din. You could say, I think that you don't have jurisdiction over me. Right? That's one of the, we consider that to be a proper response. The response then has to be considered by the Beis Din. It might be rejected by the Beis Din. But if you can prove that the Beis Din has no jurisdictional mandate or right over this individual, so then the Beis Din will withdraw their pursuit of the case. So says Ramoshe, but here the jurisdictional defense was not valid. Because what was the jurisdictional defense? The jurisdictional defense was that the other side had already gone to court. But why did the other side go to court? The other side went to court in order to obtain injunctive relief, to obtain an equal. They needed to have a temporary restraining order, and that was not something that could be issued by Beis Din. Why couldn't it have been issued by Beis Din? Because Beis Din had no jurisdiction. There was no sign shtar beruin where Beis Din would have had any jurisdiction if it had issued injunctive relief. So they had to go to the civil court in order to obtain the injunctive relief, whether it was requiring that a certain asset that was in dispute not be sold by the other party, or that, you know, certain other actions that would have been irreparable in nature and not be taken. So that injunctive relief had to be sought in court. So says Ramoshe, it's obvious. You can't refuse to go to Beis Din just because the other party filed for injunctive relief in court. In order to stop the other person from taking their money away, which would have put an end to the dispute right then and there. So that was the equal. They need injunctive relief. Don't take my money away because the money is in dispute. So that's what they needed to go to court for. She'ein lahak shivzeh kahalicha le'arkos, that you should not consider that to be like going to court. The next sentence is not even necessary. Next sentence says, and you know, in addition, the person who's refusing was actually, in this particular case, also the first person who went to court himself, so which makes, you know, his claim even more tenuous. But even without that secondary sentence in the Tshuva of Ramoshe, he's clearly saying that even if it wouldn't be the case, injunctive relief is not an automatic bar from a person being able to bring the case to Beis Din afterwards. Now, the Shevet HaLevi, Rav Vozner, okay, Rav Shmuel Vozner, writing from a totally different vantage point because he's writing from Eretz Yisrael, where the Bate Din, at least with respect to certain cases, do have automatic jurisdiction, which is vested in them from the government, at least with respect to marriage and divorce and personal status matters. So Rav Vozner takes a different approach with respect to the injunction issue. You go down to, there are different letters in the Rav Vozner. You see that it begins with letter base. Then if you go down, there's letter gimel. And then if you go down a little bit more at the beginning of the line, there is letter dalet. So in letter dalet, he says like this. He says, Vasher sha'al, binyan ha'anhagas ikos shi'asavakim tum gim tiyum gimel dayonim alo. That which you asked, does injunctive relief require the endorsement of three dayanim, or is it something that can be done without resort to the Beis Din? So he says that if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you'll find the laws of injunction are as much a part of Choshen Mishpat, or as much a part of Jewish monetary law, as any other laws. So Yira Barah, she said, Din Midinei Beis Din, that it's something which normally would be carried out by Beis Din, Misha Ba Lefnei Beis Din, Areini Mevakesh Yaklu Beis Din, that a person makes a request in front of Beis Din for injunctive relief. And he points out that there are various achronim that go on and on about different aspects and nuances of pihalacha, of all of the different aspects of injunctive relief. So he says that when is it that you need injunctive relief? When is it that you need the Beis Din in order to file for injunctive relief? When do you not? So go to the last word on the line. Yira pasha to us, Amayri. When is it that you don't? You don't. Mikach rei psak din bar. That's if you're enforcing a psak din of the Beis Din. She ain't shu suffik b'chiv a nitbar, where there is no question that a nitbar is obligated to do something. So then you could go to court. That's what we discussed last time as well. Aval ikun kol dim din Torah, but to file for injunctive relief before the din Torah has already begun. And especially if it has not been proven demonstrably that the person who's filing for the injunctive relief would necessarily prevail in front of the prevail in the case, obviously you need Beis Din. So are they really disagreeing with each other? Well, you got to look at the last paragraph as well to figure out maybe another obvious way to distinguish between the scenarios discussed by Rav Ozner and that which is discussed by Rav Moshe. So he says that maybe it really depends on whether the Beis Din is available and capable of providing for this injunctive relief. Go to towards the end of the second line of the last paragraph. Hayoski kasa ravashki ikar inyan iko mitzvah mitam lahatzil oshuk miad oshko. That the whole idea of an injunction is to save somebody from oppression, right? That's one of the major functions of Beis Din, by the way, is lahatzil oshuk miad oshko, is to save the vulnerable from oppression. That's a, we have that concept in halakha, that that's one of the reasons why we have the court system. That's something that Beis Din is supposed to be doing, right? So echadin, so he said, I'm assuming that an injunction from the Beis Din is actually going to mean something, but it's a little bit of a suffix. Echadin makom deleika Beis Din mukhan. Let's say that there is no Beis Din that's available, v'yeshal akav yidei Beis Din, and the injunction issued by the Beis Din won't actually accomplish anything. V'yeshal akav yidei asma yidei acherim, and the only way that you'd be able to obtain the injunctive relief is to go to other authorities. So he says, well, then maybe you don't need a Beis Din in that case. Me about Baruch to Tzarek Abbas Leburah, but he's not ready to give up the ship yet. He says, but there would have to be good, solid grounds for a person to file for injunctive relief. So what happens practically, what I've seen over the years, is that there are Beis Din that are a little bit trigger happy when it comes to granting injunctions when the parties have not actually signed a Shtar Beruah and they have not actually submitted officially to the binding jurisdiction of that Beis Din. A person will just come to Beis Din and say, I'm being irreparably harmed by another party unless some injunctive action is taken immediately. I'm a principal in the school and they're about to fire me and they won't let me go back in to retrieve all of my books and records and notebooks. I need an injunction immediately. And then the Beis Din, without even consulting the other party, the school, will issue an injunction. Say, we don't know the merits of the case, but we're issuing an ECO right now that you're not allowed to expel this person from your school until further notice, until this case is adjudicated. So what happens practically? Let's say the case of a school, it could be a partnership where one partner says, I want an equal, that this other partner is not going to be allowed to not going to be allowed to throw me out of the partnership facility because they're about to do that. What happens is that if the Beis Din has not been the pre-agreed upon forum for a resolution between the parties, so the other party, okay, that did not file for relief says, this Beis Din has it in for me. This Beis Din has already decided that they're, siding with the other side. And therefore, I'm never going to submit to this Beis Din, and I'm certainly not going to honor their equal. So what has the Beis Din accomplished? What the Beis Din has accomplished is that they have given the other person a sour impression of the entire Beis Din system, certainly a predisposition that they don't want to submit to this Beis Din. And unlike a court, which it's true, can issue a temporary restraining order or injunctive relief even upon an ex parte application, but a court is very different insofar as it has automatic jurisdiction over both parties. So therefore, the other party will be bound inextricably to the determination of the civil court in any event when it issues an injunction, whether they like it or not. And it's clear they don't feel that this civil court necessarily has it in for them, because the civil court really did have jurisdiction over them by virtue of just being the official court of competent jurisdiction in that area. And they know that they're going to be able to submit to their substantive defenses and course claims, when the time arises. But in the case of a Beis Din that doesn't already have jurisdiction, it ends up being counterproductive to issue an equal. So therefore, my practice, the very first year, one of the very first things that I did when I went into the, call it the Bez Din business. Business is the wrong word. The, you know, Bez Din enterprise. When I went into this Avodas HaKodesh, so one of my first cases was a case where somebody had filed for injunctive relief, and it was decided by the powers that be that the Bez Din would issue an ikul. And I spent a long time defending that ikul, which I did very persuasively and very articulately, if I say so myself, you know, marshaling, you know, every source that I could, explaining why it was legitimate for the Bez Din to issue an ikul, why the ikul would be respected. But what I saw was that the other side was not unreasonable. The other side, I saw, had legitimate grounds for feeling that the Bez Din had jumped the gun and hadn't even involved in the process and didn't have jurisdiction to issue the ikul. And ultimately, I didn't feel that, you know, as much as we pushed and persuaded, that the ikul, you know, was fully respected by the other side. So I came to the conclusion at that point in time, this is not good practice. It's not good practice for the Bez Din to be issuing ikulim unless you already have automatic jurisdiction over the parties, or the parties had already signed the Shtar Beruin, that any dispute that they have should go to Bez Din. So then it's appropriate to do like what Vosna said, and to have an adjudication in Bez Din as to whether the equal should be issued or whether the equal should not be issued. But short of that, it's probably better for Bez Din not to be involved. But if Bez Din is not going to be involved, so where is the party going to go if they need to if they need injunctive relief? So then it's appropriate to go to court. But even then, you're going to get into a little bit of trouble, because let's say the one party comes to Bez Din and says, is it okay for me to file for injunctive relief? And the Bez Din says, yes, we're not going to do it, but you can go to court. And then the Bez Din, after they file for the injunctive relief, sends a summons to the other party for the main substantive claims of the case to be adjudicated in Bez Din. The other party says, I don't trust you because you gave the other party the right to pursue injunctive relief. So how do you deal with that kind of conundrum? The best way to deal with that kind of conundrum is for Bez Din to articulate its official policies in a way that is available for everybody, that nobody needs to specifically ask about that case. Where the Bez Din just puts, nowadays, call it on its website, okay, or in some public place, says, here are official policies, that you have to go to Bez Din for the following types of disputes, but if you're going to be irremediably harmed by virtue of not filing a case in Bez Din, then you have the right to file for if you're going to be harmed as a result of waiting for the Bez Din to be involved and not filing for immediate injunctive relief. So then you would have the right to file for immediate injunctive relief, provided that in your TRO motion you make it very, very clear that as far as the substantive aspects of the case, you are prepared to litigate the substantive aspects of the case in Bez Din. That has to be part of the TRO application. And everybody has access to that declaration or instruction or guidance of the Bez Din. And therefore, the Bez Din is not specifically counseling one side to go to court or endorsing their side of the case, because these are instructions that are available to everybody. So that's what, for example, the Bez Din of America has on its website. You know, it has kind of like the guidelines of when you're allowed to go to civil court. And therefore, there's less of a notion of prejudice, which I feel is the proper way to deal with these types of situations. So that, I think, is the hevdel. That, I think, is the distinction between the approach taken by Ravos and the approach taken by the Igros Moshe, that the Moshe was dealing with a typical American situation where the Bez Din has not been the pre-chosen forum of adjudication by the parties. And Ramosha is saying that a Bez Din doesn't have the power to issue an ikul. So if one side goes to court for an ikul for temporary injunctive relief, but is prepared to litigate the underlying substantive claim in front of the Bez Din, they haven't forfeited their right to insist upon Bez Din. While Ravosna might be talking about a situation where it's an Israeli Bez Din that already has, for whatever reason, some type of jurisdictional authority over the parties, and therefore it would be appropriate in such a case. I would say as well, if parties already had signed the Shtar Beruin, I would get very angry if one party went to court, even for an injunctive, you know, motion, without consulting with the Bez Din first, because then it is appropriate for the Bez Din to be involved and to make that type of determination.
Is there any automatic jurisdiction? Are you going to discuss when a Bez Din has automatic jurisdiction?
What is
CRC? Does CRC or the RCA have automatic jurisdiction?
Like, well, automatic jurisdiction is a legal term. It means that if you issued a decree, if you issued an order, it would be binding as a matter of civil law upon the parties. So the only time that we have automatic jurisdiction is if the parties have already signed an arbitration agreement that says that they're going to submit all of their disputes in front of the Beis Din. So then we could potentially have automatic jurisdiction in that case, which is why then, if a person wanted to file for injunctive relief, it would make sense to first come in front of the Beis Din. Okay, so I wanted to get to Chov Baror. What about a case where the person has a claim that nobody in their right mind in any way, shape, or form could have possibly disputed the correctness of this claim, where one can argue that even though it hasn't already been paskened in Beis Din, that maybe a party has the right to go directly to civil court, just like we said that if a Beis Din has already issued a judgment, then a party has the right to enforce that judgment in civil court.
That's a caution
to Meisen,
right?
I'm sorry?
A case that's absolutely irrefutable?
So the Maharsham, in the second paragraph of the excerpt from the Maharsham in Gimel, says that I think that if there is he says, whenever I have a case where the Nipah basically agrees that he owes the money, there's nothing to adjudicate about. You don't really need to go to Rishus Beis Din. And then he adds a curious line that is subject to different interpretations. Because Beis Din doesn't have Beis Din doesn't have enforcement power. They're not the sheriffs. Midas Chasidus, to inform the Beis Din that, oh, by the way, I'm going to court to collect this undisputed claim. But as a general principle, it's not really necessary. If I see the Nipah admits that he owes the money, he's just refusing to pay. And the Tovea is making the claim directly to the courts. So he says he doesn't get, he basically goes on to say, I don't get so excited about it. And he says this to Maharsham in a number of different places. He quotes from Rabbi Avraham Mibuchach. Rabbi Avraham Mibuchach wrote the commentary, the Kesef HaKodshim, which appears in Shulchan Aruch. And this is the Shita, essentially, Rabbi Avraham Mibuchach. So the Rav Shmuel Bozner addresses this issue as well. What about a Chov Baror? And he says like this. He says, look at Gimel in Rav Shmuel Bozner. There's an uncollected check. There's a check that the Nipa has an invoice and he's refusing to pay. If it's clear that he's refusing to pay and the chov is indisputable, and there's no way to have it taken care of halacha, so then he says you can go to civil court as long as the way in which the debt is collected doesn't contravene halakhic principles. Halakhic principles say that you have to leave like a little bit of money, you know, for a debtor just to be able to like sleep in his bed or whatever. You can't collect all of his possessions at once, but as long as it's done in that particular fashion, so then he doesn't have a problem with it. However, others point out that Rav Asher Weiss has this. And others, that sometimes even what appears to be a rock-solid, bulletproof, ironclad obligation in the eyes of the Tovea is a very shaky and murky and nebulous ones in the eyes of the Nitba. So therefore, I almost never rely upon this. It's something that comes up a lot with schools that want to collect tuition and want to go to a collection agency and bypass the Beis Din. I say, you never know, you know, if the parent might have some sort of a tightness to why they don't, you know, really feel that they owe the money. So even in those types of what appears to be pure collection actions, it's always appropriate to turn to the Beis Din first. Okay, so we'll continue next time.